Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. It's pretty good. This is going pretty good for a Monday. Lots and lots of callers. Trent, it's probably because Trent Horn's our guest. Trent is an apologist here at Catholic Answers, a very, very fine speaker, an author of, I don't know, 1,000 books, or I don't know how many books he's written now. He's 18 years old and has written 1,000 books. Is that correct, Trent?
I'm actually 1,000 years old, and I've written 18 books.
Okay, sorry, I got that backwards.
Switched it.
The Life of a Vampire. You've done a very fine job on the books. It's included Persuasive Pro-Life, Answering Atheism, Why We're Catholic, the Can a Catholic Be a Socialist, Things the Saints Never Said. And then I also
have written a new book on Jesus called Stranger Things.
No,
all the stuff about Jesus. Didn't I write that
No,
one?
You did not write that book.
I must have confused it with a book I did read.
A book you read, maybe. Yeah. It's called A Teacher of Strange Things, and it's about Jesus. And it's getting really good reviews, Trent. And I feel I don't know how to get like 100 people to review it on Facebook. No, on Amazon, though. Like, I look at your books and it's like, I mean, partly they've been out long and my book's only been out a couple months. But how do you get like 100 people to? Go ahead.
There is something you can do, Cy, to get a ton of Amazon reviews.
Yeah.
Here's
just do them yourself.
Step number one, don't tell Amazon the following. Step number two, promise anyone if they give you a good review, you'll just send them a book.
What? That does not seem entirely ethical. It's a book about Jesus. You can't be doing criminal things.
You're right. You cannot do that, and that violates Amazon's term of service. But I know some people, even Catholic people, who basically have done that.
Well, wait a second.
Not good.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, I'm willing to beg. I don't think I'm allowed to bribe. I don't think that's permitted. But I appreciate that.
But here's the thing.
But you are the biggest selling author in the history of Catholic Answers with your book, Why We're Catholic. So I should probably take your advice. I don't know why I'm sticking to these old things called morals.
Am I also tied with the person who wrote Pillar of Fire, a.k.a. Colonne de Fuego?
But are we allowed to say who wrote that? Because I know that I know, but it might be top secret. But no, Pillar of Fire is a million seller or something. I don't know. There's so many of them out there.
But I guess you say bestseller of books.
Of books.
Of a book.
Yeah. Well, right, of a book. Right. You have the best-selling book.
A book. Well, that's grateful to hear. I will say this, Cy, about the terms of service. If you give someone a book and you tell them, hey, could you leave a review? And if they say in their review, I was gifted this book by the author, and here's what I think, you are allowed to do that.
Really? Well, I'll be insisting on that if we give any. Yes. Yeah.
So just so you know.
Here's a free book that you have to pay me back for by writing a positive review. Okay, I got it. I got it.
But that would be unethical.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to. It's a very fine line. Trent Horn, our guest, not the most ethical person in the world, but a great defender. No, I'm only teasing. He is.
Who is the most ethical person?
I think it is actually Jesus. Jesus is the most ethical person. Never sinned. Not only never sinned, because Mary never sinned. He was incapable of sinning. So
yes, could not sin. There is no possible world where he could sin because he is God. He is
God
essentially
sin.
Perfect.
Yeah, right.
Cannot. He meant that.
All right. There's a lot of good things about Jesus. The not sinning one but that should be a book. Let's write that together. A lot of good things about Jesus, where we'll just do a list of good things about Jesus.
What could we call it?
You could have top 10.
So many good things about Jesus. Huge. Tremendous.
Huge.
So many.
He's the Messiah. That's a good one.
Messiah. Yeah.
Messiah and Lord. So that's like the two top things you could be, Messiah and Lord. And it says right there in the second chapter of Luke's gospel, Messiah and Lord. 888-318-7884. See, people should get my book. It's called A Teacher of Strange Things. Or they should buy one of your hundreds of books that you slap together. They should buy the one book that I devoted my life to writing, or buy any of the books that you slap together.
Either one will make for an enriching experience.
Either one. All right, we're going to the phones, Trent, because it's Tips for Defending the Faith with Trent Horn, who is a great apologist, a defender of human life in all of its stages, and a defender of the Catholic Church. We're going to start with Rita in Portland, Oregon, listening on KBVM. Trent, quiz for you before I go to Rita. KBVM. Mm-hmm. What does the BVM stand for? Come on, Trent. Come on. You can do it. Blessed.
Let's see.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Best.
No.
Victory March.
No.
It's maybe. I would say Blessed Virgin Mary.
Okay. I feel like I helped you with that one. Oh, my gosh. You just got the
correct answer,
sound effect. Hi, Rita. Thanks for calling and waiting while we did silly things.
Hello. Hello. You guys are so funny.
Well, thank you.
Sitting here laughing. I had a conversation this morning with my daughter. I raised her and my son Catholic. I'm quite a Catholic myself. And so is my husband. But she decided to become Buddhist. And this morning I asked her why, you know, she did that. And she said, because the God of the Old Testament killed a lot of people, like in Noah's time and Sodom and Gomorrah's time. And I didn't know how to answer or defend that. So that's my question. How can I explain?
The one book I didn't mention by Trent, you are asking the perfect person for this. Because Trent wrote a book on this.
Yes, I wrote a book, Rita, called Hard Sayings, A Catholic Approach to Answering Bible Difficulties. If you stay on the line, I would gladly send you a copy of the book. Then you can skip to the chapters on that or to other parts of the Bible that have these difficulties. But I would say, Rita, that you can explain to her, well, I guess I would ask her questions such as, well, you're saying you morally disagree with the Bible describing God killing people. Why is that? And maybe she'd say something like, well, killing is wrong. You could say, well, who says? Where does this universal moral truth come from? If she's Buddhist, she might say the universe or karma. But I would say moral commands can only come from moral people. Like, the fabric of the universe can't tell me to do squat, whatever that is. But a person, a being with goodness, infinite goodness, can tell me what to do. So I guess I would ask her, you know, what is your concern here? When is killing wrong? And you could say to her, yeah, I agree that human beings cannot kill because we can't take life because we're not the ultimate authors of life. But if God is the one who gives us life and breath, he is the reason any of us exist, then he can choose to only give us a certain amount of life. So Reed, I might put it this way. Sai, if I gave you $20 today, would you be happy?
Yes. Well, happier than I am now and $20 okay, futures.
If I gave you $20 tomorrow, would you be happy?
Mm-hmm. I would be happy with that, yes.
How about the next day I gave you $20?
Yep. Okay.
And the day after I didn't give you anything. Would you be upset?
Yeah, I feel like I'm developing a habit now. You need to keep me in the custom or the manner that I've become accustomed to.
And then if I said to you, but Sai, why am I owed to give you $20 at all? Wasn't it generous enough for me to give it to you for 3 days? Would you say, yeah, I guess so.
Sorry, Trent. I shouldn't have got all upset about it. Can we still be friends?
Sorry. Okay, good. Sorry, we froze up there, but that was when you were talking, so that's good. So if I gave you money every day, I don't have to give it to you a certain amount. It's a generous gift. So if God gives us life, he gives us however much or is however little. He is the ultimate reason that we exist. And in the Bible, God is not arbitrary. He doesn't just arbitrarily intervene to kill people. In the flood or Sodom and Gomorrah, it is a judgment on sin, because what's worse than killing the body is killing the soul and living apart from God for all eternity. I tell you what, Rita, let's send you Hard Sayings, but I would like to send you also two copies of my book, Why We're Catholic, one for you and one for your daughter to read, because ultimately if she's Buddhist, I would say, look, the reason I'm Catholic, the reason I'm Christian is because Jesus Christ walked out of his own tomb, he made the universe and he came back from the dead. So I'm going to listen to him. And he believed in the Old Testament. So I'm going to trust him, even if there's parts of the Old Testament I don't understand. So I'd like to send you Why We're Catholic, Div, Your Daughter. It's a really nice, inoffensive read. You can give it to anyone, and you could read along with her and see what she thinks about that.
Oh, I'd love it. Thank you. Thank you so much. Hopefully she'll come back to the church. That's my prayer.
Amen. Let's pray. Our listeners, let's pray for Rita's daughter. Thank you, Rita.
Thank you so much.
All right, Rita, we got to take a quick break. Thank you. Thanks very much. If you're on the line, hey, hang on. We're coming back. We've got to take a quick break. More tips for the tips for the defending the faith with Trent Horn right after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live. The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
I do listen, and I love EWTN. My mother loved EWTN. It's just a wonderful way, and I thank you for what you're doing, the courage that you have for telling us how it is with Jesus, God, Mary, all of it. We have to get back to something in this country, or we're doomed.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Trent Horn is our guest. Trent, don't disrupt me while I read this ad. You always interrupt me when I read this ad. Hey, do you subscribe?
Sorry, I won't do that.
Hey, do you subscribe to the Council of Trent podcast? You can get a bunch of perks for becoming a patron of Trent's podcast. Get access to Trent's 18-hour course. Catechism study series, access the audio version of Trent's popular rebuttal series, and it is super popular, the rebuttal series, access Trent's 18-hour New Testament study series, and a coffee mug. All of that, visit TrentHornPodcast.com and subscribe. You did a really good job of not interrupting me. You always interrupt me during that ad when I'm doing that one. You did a really good job.
And that now you're completed, and I will wait my turn. If I am trying to teach my own children how not to interrupt, I must model it for them.
This is so good. Okay, all right. I got something good.
Wait for a pause. Wait for a breath. Is what I tell them. Wait for a pause.
Oh, is that what you say? That's clever. Oh, that's good. Let's go. Let's see who's up next. Omar in Chicago, watching on YouTube. Omar, thanks for the call. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi. Thanks for answering my call. I'm a Catholic, and it's about my brother. He was a Catholic. We grew up Catholic, and he's fallen away since, years back now. And we always get to talking about just the history of the scriptures, and he kind of just is real skeptical about the historicity of it all, and I try to like show him like comparisons of other historical documents, like Homer's Iliad. But he does, and I don't know. He just says it could have been changed, you know. And so I kind of wanted your take on that. See if you could help me out.
Yeah, I think, Omar, here is what you can say to him. So we do not have the original copies of the biblical documents, but we don't have the original copies of any work of antiquity. We don't have any of the ancient books from around the time of Jesus before, or even for many centuries after. So what do we do with that? Well, what scholars do is they look at the copies of those works, things that are called manuscripts. And you kind of reference this with the Iliad, but first you can tell your brother, look, we have more ancient manuscripts for the Bible, earlier, greater in number and earlier than we have for any other work in antiquity. Like for the Iliad, we only have a few fragments within the first few centuries. But we, you know, so for other ancient historical works, the first complete copy was written 1,000 years later. We have one manuscript written 1,000 years later. I want to say we have somewhere around, I think, 50 manuscripts within the first 200 years or so. I don't know if I have the numbers exactly right. But we just have far more. So I guess you could say, look, if you believe we can trust the works of Homer, the works of Aristotle, the works of Roman and Jewish historians from that time period, well, we have better evidence for the Bible that it was transmitted accurately, so you should trust it. So that'd be argument number one. If you trust other ancient works and the Bible has better evidence for it, you should trust the Bible. I'll send you, if you stay on the line, I'll send you a link to a YouTube video I did on this called How the Bible Beats Every Other Ancient Book. If you just search online, Trent Horn, Bible Beats Ancient Book, you can find the video I made where I talk about all this. And I answer atheists who make this argument.
Okay, Omar?
Number two.
Oh, sorry. I apologize.
Oh, Omar, are you still there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Number two, you should say to him, ask him, how would somebody change it? Because, you know, let's say we only have like 50 manuscripts in the first few hundred years. The thing is, 99% of ancient literature has not survived to the present day. So if we have, let's say, 50 manuscripts from the early centuries, that means there were probably thousands of manuscripts in circulation during this time period. So, and they're all over the world as well. So these manuscripts are all over the world, hundreds or even 1,000 miles away from each other. For somebody to change the Bible, he'd have to go all over the ancient world to change it, because he can't just change one manuscript. He's got to change the manuscripts in Rome, North Africa, Greece, Jerusalem, Spain, England. It's just not feasible to do that. Number two, most people knew the Bible not by reading a manuscript, but by hearing it at church. So even if you destroy the manuscripts, people knew the stories in and out and the wording. For example, Augustine talks about how St. Jerome translated a word differently in his account of Jonah, and the people were so unfamiliar with his translation choice, they threw a riot in the streets over how he translated one word. People had a lot more to fight about back then than us, you know. But they knew it. They knew it by heart from the liturgy and the assembly. And so if you tried to change it, the people would say, wait, that's not the story we've known our whole lives. And they wouldn't stand for it. So let's get your email address. I'll send you the video and then a copy of my book, Hard Sayings, which has in the appendix, I talk about how we can know the Bible was reliably transmitted.
Omar, thanks. Hang on the line. I'm going to put you on hold right now. And we're going to stay in Michigan. Where are we? Illinois or Michigan? Oh, that was from Chicago. That was Illinois. I got my Midwest states all mixed up. Colin in Michigan. Hold on now. Hang on, everybody. Got to make sure I put you on hold or you won't get your free books. Colin in Michigan, go ahead with your question.
Hi, Trent. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Colin.
I look forward to seeing you. I look forward to seeing you guys at the conference next month.
You're coming to the conference?
Yep, I'll be there.
All right. Very much looking forward to seeing you. You know, people can find out all about it at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Sure, yep.
Okay. All right, Colin.
Yep, I'm registered.
All right, good.
So when I defend the faith, and I use the approach modeled by Trent in Persuasive Pro-Life and Answering Atheism, I'm frequently accused of playing with words. And I know I'm in good company because I know Stephanie Gray was recently accused of this by Dr. Malcolm Potts in a debate, and Plato has Socrates being accused of this in some of his dialogues. But Trent, how do you respond if you get accused of this, playing with words?
Well, notice that in the Socratic dialogues from Plato, when Socrates is accused of playing words, that's just another way of his opponents saying, you're wrong, but I can't explain how you're wrong. So it depends who you're talking to, but sometimes you can bluntly reply that, I don't understand your objection. What does it mean to play with words? It sounds like you're saying, I'm wrong, you just can't explain why I'm wrong. And if that's the case, how do you know I'm wrong? Now that might be a bit blunt for some people. But you could say, all right, if you're saying I'm playing with words, that would sound like I'm using a word incorrectly. to try to make my argument. It'd be like if I said, well, love is blind. Ray Charles is blind. So Ray Charles is love. You know, or if I said, nothing is better than a well-cooked steak. Tofu is better than nothing. So tofu is better than a well-cooked steak. Someone might say, you're playing with words. And what they mean is, I'm using a logical fallacy. In those cases, undistributed middle and equivocation were the fallacies I used. Let's take the nothing is better example. Nothing is better than a steak. Tofu is better than nothing. Therefore, tofu is better than steak. That's a fallacy. I'm using the word nothing in two different ways. So you could say I'm playing with words in that I'm using a word in two different ways to make my argument. And so that's not fair. That's a fallacy. It's an error in reasoning. So I might say, if someone says you're playing with words, I might say, which word am I using incorrectly? Or what error have I made? Please tell me so I can stop doing that. And if they can't do that, then you could say, well, do you think really more you just don't agree with my conclusion, but you can't really show the wrong path I took to get there? And then let them kind of mull over it for a little bit. Is that, what do you think of that as a reply?
But I think when they lay that accusation, they're really, their complaint is with the Socratic method, and then to try to solve that by using more of the Socratic method seems like it could be futile.
Well, I think the problem is their complaint is not with the Socratic method. Their complaint is the fact that the Socratic method has exposed a fatal inconsistency in what they believe, and they're not willing to accept that at that moment. And so they just may desperately want to get out of the conversation because they know it is exposing the bankruptcy of their position. And so here you might just have to say, well, just think over what I was telling you or asking you. And if you want to talk to me more, I'd be happy to do that. And sometimes people need a little breather space to let things sink in, and either they'll humbly accept it or they obstinately will keep refusing. So that might be what I would recommend in that regard. But thank you for calling in, Colin.
888-318-7884, our number. Thanks, Colin, very, very much. We're going to go up to Canada now. John in Canada, watching on YouTube. It's Tips for Defending the Faith. John, go ahead with your question on defending the faith for Trent Horn.
Okay, I'm on?
You are, yes.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, my question was, did the Catholic Church, I'm guessing in the 1500s, did they forbid the reading of the Bible?
Sure, John. The Catholic Church never unilaterally prohibited, I guess it would depend what you mean by reading the Bible. Certainly the Church did not unilaterally prohibit reading the Bible, because reading the Bible was always a part of the sacred liturgy. So clearly the Bible was always read. It was always read at Mass. It was always read as part of the liturgy. The question may be more, did the Church prohibit individuals from reading the Bible outside the context of the liturgy? And this is not universally done, but there are cases where the Church prohibited things like certain translations from being read, or it prohibited certain groups from reading the Bible. So I know even in, like, I think it was like, what is it, the 13th? No, it would be the end of the 12th century. Pope Innocent III prohibited particular groups of people known for their heretical leanings from reading the Bible together as a lay group. He even said that it's commendable for people, individuals, to read the Bible, just not as a part of these particular groups who are bound to misinterpreting it. The problem is a lot of people only read in these groups, so it really confined it to the liturgy. But the goal here in preventing people from reading the Bible in these groups, or from reading bad translations of it, is to keep people from being misled, which did happen in the Protestant Reformation. But the Church still certainly encouraged the reading of the Bible, including in the vernacular. You go all the way back in the Eastern Church, you had the Peshitta, which is the Syriac Bible. So you had the Bible in the vernacular there. You had many vernacular translations of the Bible in the Middle Ages that were approved by the Church. But what was the concern was inferior translations. So even today, if a Catholic wants to produce a translation of the Bible, they must seek permission from the bishop to publish their translation of the scriptures. So, so I hope that is helpful. And I would also recommend maybe we can send this to you if you give us your email address. We'll send you Jimmy Akin's great new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. A wonderful book on the subject. It might have some resources if you get similar questions to this.
What version are you offering to send John in Canada? Or is it an electronic version that you're offering to send John?
Oh, he's in Canada? Probably electronic then.
Yeah, because for some reason, never solved this mystery. For some reason, we can't get mail from Catholic Answers over the border into Canada. I don't know what the problem is. It seems so close. But you got to send the electronic version. All right, John, hang on. We'll get your information. Trent Horn is here. Tips for defending the faith. More of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Thank you for listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
This is Dr. David Anders. Does the problem of evil keep you from believing in God?
Join us for Call to Communion tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. It's always fun when Trent Horn is here. Trent Horn just tearing up the internet with his debates, with his reaction videos. You can find it all over there at TrentHornPodcast.com. Also the author of a whole bunch of wonderful books, including the widely acclaimed and very popular book, Why We're Catholic. Today, Trent joins us for tips on defending the faith. If you'd like a tip on how to defend the faith against some accusation or some question or some complaint, 888-318-7884. We're going now to Toledo, Ohio, watching on YouTube, Jerry in Toledo. Thank you very much for your call, Jerry. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi, I'm a Catholic convert from Judaism, actually, and I have a bunch of Jewish friends that I'm trying to bring Christ to. And one of the many objections that I get from a particular friend is the anti-Semitic nature of the Church, and he points out St. John Chrysostom and the quote that he has, you know, saying that the synagogue is worse than a brothel, and that, you know, we're not to even be in contact with Jews, and you know, even modern Catholic scholars like E. Michael Jones and what his views on the Jews are. So I guess if you could answer, what is sort of the church teaching on that, and how would you respond to someone like that?
Yeah, so I would say, Jerry, and this also is important to me as well. Half of my family is Jewish. My grandfather's name was Hornstein. He changed his name after World War II because he got beat up for being a Jew. So he changed it to Horn instead of Hornstein. So, and even myself now, people who do know that I have a Jewish ethnicity, I, on occasion, within traditionalist circles online, and of course, I'd say the vast majority of people who identify as traditionalist Catholics, I would identify as a traditionalist Catholic, are not anti-Semitic in any way. But that being said, I have seen among the far, far right in the church an ugly strain of anti-Semitism that needs to be countered. In the Second Vatican Council's declaration on non-Christian religions in Nostra Aetate, it makes it absolutely clear that the Jewish people are not specially condemned by God. Anti-Semitism must be rejected in all of its forms. It's very clear that the church teaches, for example, it was not the Jewish people as an ethnicity who are responsible for the death of Jesus. Rather, it was Jewish and Roman leaders in particular, as well as all of humanity whose sins put Jesus on the cross. So the church abundantly opposes anti-Semitism. And yet, even in doing that, anti-Semitism is an evil. And it is an evil that infects things, and it has infected the church, both today in some circles and even among some writers in the past. And it's very unfortunate. But that does not take away from the church's universal teaching, what St. Paul says in Galatians 3:28, that in Christ there is neither Jew nor Greek. In Romans chapter 11, Paul makes it clear that he has hope that all Israel will be saved, which probably means he has hope for people from descendants of all the tribes of Israel, that throughout the wide Jewish diaspora, there'll be people from every tribe who will come to know Jesus Christ. So a few points on anti-Semitism there. I would say some people who read the New Testament think it's anti-Semitic, such as when John's Gospel talks about the Jews, the Judeoi, they were afraid of the Jews. The Jews did this. But you have to remember, of course, that everybody in the Bible who wrote the scriptures, except for Luke, they were Jews. Jesus was Jewish. The apostles were Jewish. So when the Bible talks about the Jews being enemies of Jesus, it is talking about the Jewish leadership, or in particular, specific members of Judea who had almost secularized themselves. It'd be like if I said, oh, the Republicans did this, or the Democrats did that. I'm not talking about every registered Republican or Democrat. I'm talking about the party leadership doing things I disagree with. Then when you go further in church history, you see a tension that arises between trying to be faithful to the Jewish people and understanding that the church understood they have a right to worship, that they have preserved the ancient tradition of Abraham, so they're not like pagans, for example. You shouldn't destroy Jewish synagogues, things like that. Those are tolerated. But yet people still wanting the Jews to accept the Messiah. And so you have some church fathers who have some nasty things that they say that we've developed our understanding that's not appropriate. But you also have others who have a view almost ahead of their time. There's a good book on this subject by Paula Fredrickson called Augustine and the Jews, A Christian Defense of Jews and Judaism, where he kind of goes against that strain in talking about the importance of philo-Semitism, or a love of Judaism. For your friends or family members who have hesitancy, I would recommend Roy Schumann has a book, Salvation is from the Jews. So I'll recommend a few resources. Roy Schumann, Salvation is from the Jews. And Brant Petrie, he has books called Jesus and the Jewish Roots of the Eucharist, Jesus and the Jewish Roots of Mary. Very, very wonderful books to talk about how Catholicism really is the fulfillment of Judaism. So that might be where I would start with those resources. Is that at least a helpful starting point?
Yeah, I think so. I think the problem that, you know, I think some people have is they'll say that, you know, it's not the ethnicity that they're against. It's that, you know, Jesus says that, or sort of the spirit, like what, I don't know if you're familiar with E. Michael Jones, but, you know, some of the things that he says kind of bother me, having my Jewish ethnicity, but, you know, also he, you know, tries to say that it's not ethnicity, but it's the fact that they are people who rejected Christ, and therefore they have some sort of spiritual, I don't know, like a spiritual element that causes them to be, you know, part of bad things like communism and you know, things.
Yeah. Right, but the problem with E. Michael Jones and what he is bringing up is that he fallaciously zeroes in on some Jewish people, and it may very well be the case there are some Jewish people who were involved in legalizing abortion or working with communists. There are also atheists. There were also Catholics. Think of, you know, like I've heard this argument that Jewish people were involved in legalizing abortion or in other evils throughout history. But then to say the Jewish race as a whole is uniquely responsible for these kinds of atrocities because a few Jewish people were is totally boneheaded and stupid. So I believe anti-Semitism should be called out for whatever it is. And there is a large following of people who identify as traditional Catholics who may take umbrage at me saying that, but I don't care because truth is what ultimately matters. And that E. Michael Jones and others who would follow this line of argument, what about the Catholics who were involved in legalizing abortion or pornography or who have been involved in all kinds of wars and acts of evil throughout history. I'll send you an article that goes into more detail about this, Jerry, if you would like. But to try to say there are two extremes. If we say Jewish people have no need of Jesus, that is incorrect. But if we single out the Jewish ethnicity, they might say, well, I'm talking about the religion. Well, if you single out adherents of Judaism and you don't speak about atheists or Protestants or Eastern Orthodox or even fallen away Catholics in the same way, and you promote conspiracy theories or you promote harsh invective language towards people of the Jewish religion that you don't give to other non-Catholics, then even though if you're not talking about the Jewish ethnicity, just the Jewish religion, I would say you're still guilty of anti-Semitism in that regard because you are engaging in a particular kind of behavior and marginalizing of the Jewish religion because you see it as some kind of unique or dangerous threat as opposed to any other non-Catholic system. So, Jerry, give the call screener your email address, and I'll send you an article that goes into detail about that. But that's just what I would say in general, is that, once again, no matter who someone's ethnicity is, we're all equal in Christ, and if someone's religion is non-Catholic, they are in error, and we ought to help them come to know Jesus, the Jewish Messiah, who has given us the Catholic Church, not promote conspiracy theories or boneheaded thinking about them.
Is that all satisfying? Jerry, you want to leave us your email?
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very, very much. I mean, certainly the great efforts of many church leaders like Pope John Paul, or you think of Jean-Marie Lustiger, the Cardinal of Paris in recent decades, to kind of repair and replenish and restore the relationship between Jews and Catholics. All of that is to the good, but it does point to the fact that that repair was needed because there has been a long tradition of Catholic anti-Semitism that's not official. It's not the official teaching of the Church. We're not saying that.
It is among us Catholic people.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's at the fringe. And like I said, I only encounter it in fringe elements on the internet. It's not uncommon for me to come across Catholics, for example, who deny the mainstream historical account of the Holocaust. It's not uncommon
Come on.
For me to find Catholics who deny the mainstream account, and it's very clear the reason they do that is because they have a particular animus towards Jewish people, and they want to obscure one of the greatest acts of evil committed against the Jewish people because of that animosity they have. I've done a whole episode of my podcast refuting Holocaust denialism, or what they would call revisionism, which is really denialism. And so we as Christians must stand against that. There are ugly things at the fringes of the church. I would say you've got fringe people who think there's nothing wrong with sodomy. That's boneheaded. Yeah. You have fringe people who think there's nothing wrong with denying the Holocaust. That's also boneheaded.
Amen,
we should
brother.
stick to the truth, and I'm not going to shy away from saying that, because I want Jewish people who are listening to this to come to know the Messiah and to know that salvation is from the Jews, as Jesus himself said in the Gospel of John.
He did indeed. But you do get the sense, Trent, at least I do, that some of the fringier groups that are proposing the idea that we're sticking to the truth while none of the rest of you have the guts to stick to the truth, one of the ways they stick to their so-called truth is to kind of continue this tradition of anti-Semitism. And the only thing that can be said for it is, look, you're not that brave by being an anti-Semite. You're not upholding a noble tradition. You're doing something gross.
I'll tell you, probably not. One sign you're brave is that you only feel comfortable saying this through an anonymous Twitter account.
Oh, yeah. Well,
courageous.
I don't mind if you tweet me. Tweet all you want. It's got to end, this Christian anti-Semitism. It's got to end. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Trent Horn.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
You know, I have never seen women who want to be equal absolutely degrading themselves. And yet the media degrades your nature, your beauty as a woman, your goodness. Let us pray. At some point, our dear Lord touches their hearts.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. 888-318-7884, the number. Trent Horn, our guest. Tips for defending the faith. Tips for defending the faith. You're welcome to call. That was Jim in Maryland. Let's go to Jim in Maryland right now. That wasn't Jim that we just spoke with. Jim in Maryland, watching on YouTube. You are up next. Go ahead, please, with your question for Trent Horn.
Hey, Si and Trent.
Hi, Jim.
Yeah, I call you guys once in a while because I have this partial sight disability, so I'm always giving you a hard time about making your books available on audio and in ways that I can read them.
Jim, anyway, I got to tell you. Can I just tell you? Because I know we've spoken about this before.
I have
read out loud into a microphone my entire book, A Teacher of Strange Things. It's just they haven't gotten around to doing the detail work, you know, like making my voice sound good and all that, which requires a team of engineers to come in and fix the mistakes I make. But we are going to have it out, and I'm going to give you a free copy of the audiobook, Jim, when it's out.
That's a beautiful thing, Si. That's great.
Well, we'll see.
I was able to download The Hard Sayings, and I've been looking at that. And like all lazy readers, I didn't start at the beginning. I just jumped in where I wanted to see things, and
It's quite all right.
Reading about the ban and everything and the various explanations of that in the Old Testament, and that was very interesting. But I had a question about something I consider to be a hard saying in the New Testament, And I couldn't think of it where it is offhand in which gospel, but the passage about where Jesus sends the apostles out and says, you won't even get around to all the cities around here before I return. And I wondered how you understand it, because it sounds like Jesus misunderstood about how long it would be before his second coming. So.
Right, yeah. So there's two episodes. That there are different sayings of Jesus where he talks about how you shall not visit all the towns of Israel before you see the Son of Man coming in glory. Or he'll talk about the coming in glory, or you know, the coming of the Son of Man. Or you all of these things, he talks about these calamities, these disasters that will unfold within the lifetime of the people who are listening to him. I believe that Jesus is referring to two separate events in many of these instances. One, especially the calamities, is a reference to the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, which happened in the year 70 AD, which was within the lifetime of many of the people who were listening to Jesus. So that could be described using the biblical language of visitation. The Old Testament often talked about how Yahweh or God visited Babylon or Egypt to bring them destruction. And so the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem was often seen as an act of divine judgment upon the people. That's why Jesus said in the parable of the fig tree that it should have fruit and it doesn't. And so the fig will be destroyed and cut down. And that was fulfilled in the destruction of the temple. So it could be that Jesus himself is being described as returning. He's talking about his return in the destruction visited upon the temple. Another thing, when Jesus talks about, some of you standing here shall see the Son of Man coming in glory. When Jesus says that, just a few verses later, I believe that's in Mark chapter 9. So Jesus says it in Mark 8, then a few verses later in Mark 9, it describes Jesus going, taking the apostles up to the top of Mount, traditionally assumed to be Mount Tabor, for the transfiguration. That happened after that. Those of you standing here, those apostles were with him, Peter, and the others went up to the top of Mount Tabor to see Jesus in his glory, in his transfigured glory, that he said, you standing here, you will see that. That's also an interpretation, I believe, that Pope Benedict XVI has held for that passage. I tell you what, though, Jim, I'll send you a copy of Counterfeit Christs that has this. I have recorded the audio version of Counterfeit Christs. I just got to go and bug them to turn that into an audio book. But I have a lot on my plate, though, Jim, because they want me to come in and re-record this book, Strange Things. They said that it didn't test well, the first guy who did the voice. So I'm re-recording the Strange Things book. I'm just kidding. I'm not going to do that.
I hadn't been informed of this.
I hear you had a hard time with alternatives, so I guess.
Oh, you remember that, Jim. Oh, I yeah, but I'm really working on my pronunciation. But yeah, did you ever get stuck with a word and you just, I would read that line over and over, and every time I would read it, it would come out alternative instead of alternative. I just couldn't get it to have the right number of syllables. Trent, if you would read my book, though, I'm sure it would sell way more. Like, as read by Trent Horn? Come on. People would want that. It would.
I'll tell you what would make it sell well a lot more, Si, is if you came here and moved here in Northern Virginia. We have a wonderful city called Alexandria, and you should move here so then Trent Horn and all of us could legitimately refer to you as Cyril of Alexandria. And then I think that would be very
cool. Look at that. Look at that.
Jim, you're no dope. That is.
It would give a nice bump to your book sales, too.
I think you're right. If the book was by Cyril of Alexandria, sure. All right. I got to ask my brother Methodius if he'll move with me, but I don't know if he will. Jim, you're all right. Did we do all right by you, or do you have more?
We'll leave it there for tonight. I'll bug you again soon.
Yep. And as soon as you hear me say that the audiobook is out, get in touch with me and I'll send you a free copy of it.
Thank you, Si.
Yep. And if it doesn't come out, we'll find some alternative. Let's go to Tom in Massachusetts, the very seat of world civilization, watching on YouTube. Tom, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Trent Horn.
Hello. So my question for you, Mr. Horn, is how can the Catholic communion be
considered to be fundamentally Catholic, that is, Catholic from all of the schisms, whether it be the Great Schism or the Schism of the Council of Chalcedon, how can it be considered to be Catholic, that is to say, universal or in respect to the whole, when both that communion and the communion that would later be known as the Eastern Orthodox were fundamentally monolithic and non-liturgically diverse, like the Oriental Orthodox communion is, where you have the Coptic Rite, the Ethiopian Rite, the Syriac Rite, the Malankara Rite, the Armenian Rite, as fundamentally part of what makes Oriental Orthodoxy one, and yet this diversity fundamentally exists. Whereas with the Great Schism of 1054, you have the differing parties differing for reasons that would make the Latin Communion and the Eastern Orthodox Communion liturgically monolithic and non-Catholic, non-universal.
Well, Tom, I'm not sure if I understand your objection. Are you saying that the Eastern Orthodox and the Oriental Orthodox, are you saying they have a monolithic structure even though they have different churches?
I'm saying that both the Catholic Communion and the what is known as the Eastern Orthodox Communion,
right,
that these are both monolithic communions as far as like what has divided them since their respective schisms, and the Oriental Orthodox Communion is the only one which has maintained a fundamental diversity from the beginning of these respective schisms. Because we both believe that the apostles carried on the faith in a Catholic way, where they passed down these various liturgies, these various liturgical rites, and it's what makes are diverse.
Okay, so Tom, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. Do you identify? Are you a member of an Oriental Orthodox or an Assyrian Church of the East?
The Coptic Orthodox Church, yeah.
Oh, is it? Yeah. But Coptic Orthodox, is that a part of the Orientals who broke away in the 5th century, or is it 11th century?
Yes, that's part of the Oriental Orthodox Communion, and the Assyrians are the Nestorians that broke off around a similar time.
Correct, yes.
Assyrians.
Okay, but so would you identify then? Yeah, so, but you, anyway, I don't want to get into the nitty gritty there. Most people don't realize you have the Great Schism in the 11th century. We had actually our first Great Schism was in the 5th century. Well, what I would say though is if there is a church that is Catholic or universal, when we say Catholic Church, I think we could say Catholic churches, because you have, while the Latin Rite is the largest one and it is anchored by the Bishop of Rome, you do have Catholic churches, even going all the way back to the beginning. The Apostle Thomas, you have him founding the Church of India that still exists today in the Catholic Church in the Syro-Malabar Rite. So, like, when I've been to World Youth Day, that was about 15 years ago, it seems very, very universal, much more universally represented than maybe you would see in Oriental Orthodoxy. So I apologize if I didn't quite get the meat of your objection, but I feel like even though the Latin Rite is the largest and it's kind of an anchor in some respects, the differences in all of the different rites really does show the universality and the diversity in the Catholic Church, whereas I think the Oriental Orthodox or Eastern Orthodox lack that kind of diversity and geographic widespread nature. But we're almost at the end of the show. Do you have one last thought if I didn't quite get your concern?
Yeah. Well, I see where you're coming from. The modern Eastern Catholic churches are a novelty. The Catholic Church from the time of these respective schisms, they were monolithic from there, and so their foundation of why they schismed and also on the circumstances they schismed, they've had these schisms, it was monolithic.
Sure. Well,
has always been diverse.
Right. Well, I would say actually we've had diversity all throughout, even in the early first 5 centuries. A good book for our listeners on this is called Rome and the Eastern Churches by Aidan Nichols. At shop.catholic.com, we have a booklet, 20 Answers, Eastern Catholicism, for those who want to go deeper in the subject. Sorry we couldn't talk more, Tom. Maybe another time.
Thanks, Tom. And thanks to you, Trent Horn. I really appreciate 2 hours. It was a lot of fun to get to talk with you for 2 hours.
Oh, absolutely. Super fun.
Find Trent over at TrentHornPodcast.com. He's doing these amazing reaction videos, and you really should watch him. TrentHornPodcast.com. Tomorrow, I don't know if it's some kind of the moon and the planets aligned, but we have Jimmy and Tim both. We got an hour of open forum, one with Tim Staples, one with Jimmy Akin. Amazing.